Save big on your landscaping project now at Menards. Whether you're installing a patio or a new retaining wall, Menards has the blocks you need to get the job done right. We carry the largest in-stock selection ready to take home today. Stop in and get our 12-inch smooth patio block on sale now. Save big on concrete landscape blocks at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big.
$40,000 on shoes?
What's the matter, Morty?
Coral, the Sphinx.
Can't you buy our whole dress?
Coral, the Sphinx.
Great gowns.
Coral,
beautiful gowns.
Fashion has changed.
Coral,
no, it hasn't.
Hi, I'm Lauren Garoni.
And I'm Chelsea Fairless.
And welcome back to the Every Outfit Podcast.
We've had a big week, lots of adventures.
Lots of Every Outfit coded events happening in the larger Southern California region.
We went to see Candace Bushnell's one-woman show this weekend.
Which was not in Los Angeles, but instead was in Costa Mesa. Which, for those who don't live in Los Angeles, or I guess Southern California, is in Orange County. And we were originally like, why wouldn't she do this in Los Angeles? And then we got to the venue and we were like, oh, we understand now.
Oh, for sure. Also, we would have told our Los Angeles listeners about this show had we known about it more than 2 days before it happened. Like, this was an emergency day trip to Costa Mesa.
I received a text that was like, Paul better be able to watch the baby because we need to turn this around in 24 hours and go and see Candace in Costa Mesa. And because we were going to Orange County, we decided to make our first pilgrimage, but not our last, to the South Coast Plaza.
Which is a luxury shopping mall that was really fabulous. Noteworthy to us because it has a Courrèges store and an Alaïa store and a Miu Miu store. None of these things exist in Los Angeles.
The closest experience or shopping experience that it felt like is when we were in Miami and they have the Miami Design District, which has literally every single designer luxury store and then also every designer furniture store within a 5x5 block radius.
And this is the Orange County version of that. But I love how you were immediately like, Tat, Chell, chill on the PDA. You guys are going to get hate crime. It's a very conservative place.
Yeah, I said something to that effect only because at a certain point I looked around at the mall and I was like, you two are not only the only lesbians here, but we are the only people who are brunettes. In, I think, a 2 mile radius.
Not to mention the only people wearing black.
Oh, yeah, that also made us outliers as well. But we had a delightful time.
Such a good time. The show was great. I had heard good things about it from friends of mine that had seen it in New York, but I was really impressed with what she did. And as someone that has also sort of created a live Sex in the City themed stage show, it was interesting to see what she did.
So what is the show called again?
True Tales of Sex, Success, and Sex in the City. She has been doing this show since early in the pandemic. It debuted in New York in 2021. And since then, she has performed it all over the world, basically everywhere but Los Angeles.
And as I said before, we now understand why she specifically performed it. Three performances. We went to the Sunday matinee, but it was packed with divorcees in pink wearing, you know, their
espadrille wedges.
Yeah, I was going to say high heels, but you are correct. It was more an espadrille wedge vibe. But the structure of the show is she is trying to answer the question, is there still Sex in the City? Which comes from her 2019 book of the same name. But really, the one-woman show is her charting how Candace became Carrie Bradshaw, became Candace again.
Yeah. And it opens with this really incredible video montage of her 90s television appearances. It's like her on Oprah, her on Charlie Rose, her on CNN. So incredible.
Yes, it starts with that. And then also you have not spoken about the set decoration, which really gives us something to think about for when Every Outfit does another live tour.
Totally, because the stage was covered with shoes. Some of the shoes had their own little spotlights on them, and they were shoes from her actual shoe collection.
We were up in the balcony because that's where we could get tickets. So we had a bird's eye view of the women in the front row who kept touching Candace's shoes before the show started, so much so, and taking selfies with them, that the staff had to come and be like, "You cannot touch the shoes."
Yeah, it was all very cute. And she basically tells her life story chronologically, and then she weaves in life lessons as well as this recurring game show bit called Real or Not Real, where she shows us scenes from Sex and the City and asks us to determine, like, did this happen to her or was this just for the show?
And pretty much everything really happened to Candace in some way, shape, or form. But I think the most revealing things for me about the show were the fact that the real life Charlotte, Miranda, and Samantha in her life, personality and sex drive wise, were all similar to her.
We're all like Samanthas, basically.
Another recurring bit is her on the phone, and it goes from her being on, you know, a landline to a cell phone to a flip phone to then an iPhone, which is a great way to show the passage of time. But, you know, the show begins with her talking to Miranda, who's getting like fucked by a stockbroker in a cedar closet in the Hamptons.
Yeah, it's definitely grittier than Sex and the City. She talks about having a threesome with a female sex worker. She talks about cocaine use throughout the show, which mysteriously absent from Sex and the City.
Well, another recurring theme is sort of, I wouldn't say her disillusionment, but her surprise at the TV conventions that were added onto her source material when her column, her book, Sex and the City, became the show Sex and the City, such as the fact that Charlotte, Miranda, and Samantha became more archetypes than women who have overlapping personality traits.
Totally.
And then the other shocking thing, at least for me, was her genuine belief that the show would end after season two when Mr. Big marries another woman, because that is what happened to Candace. Her Mr. Big unceremoniously broke up with her, which she gets into the details of in this show, which is they were sharing a house in the Hamptons. She's telling a story at a dinner party. He tells her to shut up in front of everyone. And then the next day he's like, we got to break up.
Well, also he was cheating on her with some girl that lived in Aspen.
Yeah, she has a very funny line about like, who goes to Aspen in the summertime? We talked about the real life Mr. Big, Ron Galati. Recently there was, or semi-recently, there was a New York Times style section piece where he told his side of the story, which was that he and Candace were not that serious. Although, I don't know, sharing a house in the Hamptons seems a little more serious than a fling. But anyway, I didn't realize until seeing this show how much of a feminist Candace really is. At her core, the real life Carrie Bradshaw, which she gave that moniker to her column because when she finally got her column in the New York Observer, her parents were like, we got a subscription. And the first column she ever did was about her going to a sex party. And she was like, I cannot have my parents reading this. Oh, I know what I'll do. I'll create an alter ego.
Yeah. But yeah, to go back to the feminism of it all, the central thesis of the show is really that you have to be your own Mr. Big. She repeatedly stresses the importance of financial independence from men. She talks about how she built her life in a way so she doesn't have to rely on a man. And it's quite cool considering that while she has performed the show all over the world, like I said, she is performing the show in many conservative enclaves like Costa Mesa, Palm Beach, what have you. And it is very cool of her.
Well, another thing that is central to her is supporting and maintaining your female friendships above everything else. And how horrified Candace was to see that not only did they bring Mr. Big back for season three, but they made essentially her alter ego, cheat on a man, which is something that Candace would never do because she would never want to hurt another woman in that way. And then on top of it, the show got even more popular because of that.
Totally. And people actually really liked Mr. Big, similarly to what happened with Girls. Like, Adam was written to be a shitty character that the audience ultimately ended up falling in love with.
And then also Candace's belief that perhaps Mikhail Baryshnikov was cast as Carrie's boyfriend because she herself was married to a ballet dancer at the time.
Totally. And she doesn't really go into the nitty gritty of this, but we know that she was only really involved in the show for the first couple of seasons. Then she was iced out because she didn't write the pilot script for Sex and the City. She didn't really ever get the money that you would think that she would get from Sex and the City. In this show, she talks about the fact that she only really got the money to buy an apartment when Lipstick Jungle was optioned for television, which is fucked up. And it does kill the Sex and the City fantasy that we all have of what her life must have been like. But it's cool that she's going on stage and talking about her finances and showing us a picture of her real closet that has like wire hangers and shit in it to compare it to the Carrie Bradshaw fantasy in the first movie.
Yeah, that was part of the fact or fiction game show where she was like, yeah, no, you only get that closet if you marry a finance bro.
Yeah.
Our next sponsor is Smalls. They make fresh human-grade food for cats. It's made from the same stuff you or I would eat, but formulated specifically to help cats thrive. The last time I spoke about Smalls, I discussed how I recommended it to my friend Kayla, who has rescued 3 cats and was not happy with the cat food she was using. Unlike other cat foods, Smalls recipes are over 80% animal protein, and they never use fillers or artificial ingredients. Well, she purchased some, hopefully using our promo code, and loves it. Or I guess her cats are the ones who love it. Anyway, here's a text she sent me about it. I love never running out of cat food because my freezer is stocked. My cats are partial to the smooth bird style, and Bear, that's one of her cats, was on a prescription diet that was $100 a pallet, just 24 stinky cans for her IBS, and it didn't help, and Smalls actually did. Also, cat food smells awful, but this is just human grade, so it smells like actual food. Don't believe my friend? Well, Forbes ranks Smalls the best overall cat food, and after switching to Smalls, 88% of cat owners reported overall health improvements. If you're spooked by commitment, don't be. You can try Smalls risk-free. They'll refund you if your cat won't eat their food. So stop serving your little carnivore a bowl of processed shortcuts. For a limited time, because you are an Every Outfit listener, get 60% off your first order, plus free shipping and free treats for life when you head to smalls.com/outfit. One last time, that's 60% off your first order, plus free shipping and free treats for life when you head to smalls.com/outfit.
Also, a really dishy moment in this show, she talks about when she moved to New York after high school and how she immediately moved in with Gordon Parks, who is a photographer and an author. We've talked about this relationship before, but I did some Googling and Candace moved to New York in 1978 when she was 19, which would have made Gordon Parks 66 at the time.
She doesn't really get into detail about why Gordon Parks is the first person she calls, but she's like, he's the only author I knew, to which Chelsea and I in the audience were like, I thought he was a photographer.
Yeah, because he's heavily featured in the Parsons photography history curriculum that we all experienced as freshmen, basically. But I don't know if we connected the dots when And Just Like That came out, but in LTW's apartment, there's this very famous Gordon Parks photo of a very chic black woman and her young daughter standing underneath a sign that says colored entrance. It is one of the defining photographs about segregation. And when Charlotte first came over to LTW's house and was talking about all of the different black artists in her collection, she literally could have said, my friend Carrie used to fuck that guy. That is crazy.
Well, do you want to get into the other dishy thing of the show, which is she does not reference Sarah Jessica Parker by name. She only refers to her as Matthew Broderick's girlfriend when discussing the casting of Sarah Jessica Parker as Carrie Bradshaw in the pilot of Sex and the City.
Which is noteworthy because Sarah Jessica Parker was a movie star at that point.
And a New York It girl. So there's no way that Candace and Sarah Jessica Parker's lives did not overlap in some way, shape, or form over their decades of living in New York City. I mean, not to spoil things, but we did get the answer that there is indeed still Sex in the City.
Yes.
It turns out these kooky bitches in their 50s and 60s, they still want to fuck.
Yeah, and her crew is so iconic. It's like Countess Luann and yeah. Nicole Miller. Who else is she hanging out with?
Dorinda, famously. Dorinda,
yeah. Love Candace. Great show. If it comes to your city, go see it. Go support our girl. Have a Cosmo.
It's very inspiring. Not just the content of the show, but also the idea of like, I'm just going to tour this show of places I would like to vacation.
Good for her.
So you have taken your wife to not one, but two Isabelle Huppert screenings where she appeared in person. There is something that the American Cinematheque does every year, this programming called Bleak Week.
Bleak Week, the cinema of despair, which is a film festival about the most depressing, fucked up movies that exist. They've been doing it for 5 years now. It's really a global film festival at this point. Like 80-something theaters internationally participated in Bleak Week this year. For the Los Angeles Festival, Isabelle Huppert was the guest of honor. So they screened a ton of her movies. She was present in person for, I think, 4 of those screenings. And I saw The Piano Teacher on Monday, and then I saw Elle on Wednesday.
And you brought your wife, who has not seen either of these films. And how did it go? I can only guess.
She did not love The Piano Teacher. She was like, the performance is amazing, obviously. But she was like, I don't get what the big deal is. I don't even think this movie is that fucked up. Like, so what? She's like a pervert that likes to self-harm. Like, who cares? Whereas to me, I'm like, this is the most disturbing movie I've ever seen in my life. But she was very, like, not fazed by the sort of violent elements of it, which surprised me.
She might have spent too much time with us. We also have been hyping up The Piano Teacher to her for years. My fear was, because your wife, if I may say, has a bit of film-induced narcolepsy, that I worried that she was going to fall asleep before the fucked up stuff started.
Totally. No, she stayed awake for both of them, blessedly, but she was more into Elle, which really is like an art house version of Law & Order Special Victims Unit, when you think about it.
Someone recently put on Twitter the clip of Isabelle Huppert and Sharon Stone on SVU. We have to do that episode.
It's such a good one. But yeah, it was such a different crowd from Candace in Orange County, because it was like mostly white straight film bros. Not enough women and gays for my comfort.
At both of these screenings.
Yeah. Lots of loud throat clearing and popcorn chewing.
And also, I'm sure as soon as the lights went up, just feverishly updating their letterbox reviews.
Totally. But the Q&As were really funny, because she's just like so unsentimental about her work, and she really doesn't have much to say about process or technique. It's very like, I read the script, I meet the director, I film the movie, and she's very just like dry about everything.
Well, I remember when Elle came out, and certainly because she was nominated for several awards, I believe she won the Golden Globe, but lost out on the Oscar. Not if we had control over anything, but I remember this conversation came up because of the subject matter of Elle and the fact that it was directed by Paul Verhoeven. For those who have not seen the movie Elle, I mean, the movie begins with her getting raped and her sort of uncovering and her obsession with her rapist. And I remember a lot of people asked her, like, how do you deal with, you know, The Piano Teacher, this? How do you deal with this material? And she's like, I just say it, I do it, and that is it. I go home.
That's exactly what it is. Like, she did not find filming The Piano Teacher to be emotionally taxing at all. She just showed up and did what she did. It's funny, in both of these Q&As, the most sort of passionate and excited I ever saw her get about her own work was when she was talking about working with the cat in Elle. She was talking about this cat like this is the Meryl Streep of cats. Like, never in my life have I met an animal actor with the level of talent as that gray cat that she has in that movie.
It was excellent cacting.
It was. But yeah, she's amazing and she looked great. At The Piano Teacher, she was wearing Demna Gucci, like a very tight suit. and the horse bit stilettos that I wanted you to buy. And then at the L screening, she was in what I assume was either like a new Balenciaga Canadian tuxedo type situation, or possibly could have been Michael Ryder Celine. But she looked great at both.
I assume they weren't taking questions from the audience, because I know that would have been your question.
No, they did take questions from the audience. And thankfully, people kept it together for the most part. It wasn't like that Nicolas Cage Q&A that we went to once.
At the Miami Film Festival, yeah. I don't know if we've discussed this on the podcast, but honestly, there is no more secondhand embarrassment for me than Q&As. I don't know if it's growing up here, living here, but Q&As after film screenings are some of the worst experiences I've ever had.
Oh, I still have nightmares about this screening of The Birds I went to with Tippi Hedren in person, but anyway, that was fun. You were missed.
Sorry.
It's fine. You have a baby.
I have a baby. We also, because of this, became members of the American Cinematheque, and they locked down the tickets to two.
So rude. But I had also never been to the Egyptian Theater before. I didn't realize how small it was.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like that piano teacher screening, especially because it is the 25th anniversary of that film, could have been in a theater, you know, akin to the one at the Academy Museum that is huge.
I mean, imagine just every pervert in Los Angeles would have been at that screening. That's why they had to put it in a smaller theater. We got to cap the LA perverts.
It's true. And one of the moderators did ask her straight up, like, you play all these perverts, what's that about? And she was like, well, the common thread is obviously me.
We love a self-aware queen.
And just kind of let that hang. Let the audience sit with that. I loved it.
This episode is brought to you by IQBar, our exclusive snack, hydration, and coffee sponsor. IQBar protein bars, IQ Mix hydration mixes, and IQ Joe mushroom coffees are the delicious low-sugar brain and body fuel you need to win your day. You've heard me talk about IQBar before. I love everything they have going on. Let's start with the IQBar themselves. They're the smarter snack choice with plenty of plant protein, tons of fiber, and no added sugar. My current favorite flavor is lemon blueberry. I keep them in my car on the off chance I or a passenger get hangry. And guess what? The other day, Paul was with me and he was feeling peckish and he had the lemon blueberry IQ bar and said it tasted just like a blueberry muffin. Then we have the IQ Mix, which is a zero sugar drink mix that hydrates with electrolytes, improves mood, and boosts clarity. I love their yuzu mango flavor, which was a collaboration with Michelin star chef Thomas Keller. All IQ Bar products are clean label certified and entirely free from gluten, dairy, soy, GMOs, and artificial ingredients. They may be a sponsor of this podcast, but I genuinely use IQ Bar in my daily life. Do I use my own promo code when I buy my IQ Bar order? Of course, and you should too. And right now, IQ Bar is offering our special podcast listeners 20% off all IQ Bar products, including the Ultimate Sampler Pack, plus free shipping. To get 20% off, text OUTFIT to 64,000. Text OUTFIT to 64,000. That's OUTFIT to 64,000. Message and data rates may apply. See terms for details.
But anyway, moving on, we have one more Sex and the City adjacent thing to talk about.
Yes, we learned this past week that Jason Lewis, Smith Jared, has moved to Costa Rica and is writing a fantasy novel trilogy.
Trilogy? I wish it was a trilogy. Aren't there like 8 books?
I believe it's 3 trilogies. First, this is such an interesting PR piece because it reads like a press release announcing Jason Lewis's new fantasy book series, but it's actually just a vague interview about him moving to Costa Rica and how he's currently writing a fantasy book series. There's no distribution as far as I read.
No.
But kudos to this publicist for getting this placement, because it is very, very hard to get anyone to cover anything, especially a long-form interview in The Hollywood Reporter when you don't actually have a product to promote.
Nor is there anything Sex and the City related in the news right now.
No, and beyond that, the other thing that came out with Jason Lewis this week is he is starring in a vague Smith Jared-esque Instagram commercial for a hard soda, but that's not even referenced in The Hollywood Reporter piece.
No. But this commercial has so many Sex in the City dog whistles. Basically everything that you can do short of being sued for infringing on their IP, which is a world where we exist in often.
Honestly, inspiring as well.
Totally. Although he's clearly playing the absolute hunk who is famously sober.
Yes, the ad is titled The Hunk is Back, referencing when Smith Jared was the absolute hunk, a poster that we have that hangs in our office. And you see a Samantha basically walking in the background. For those who haven't seen this, he gets sushi thrown at him, but this time he's able to catch it, unlike in the first film when Samantha throws sushi at him.
It's wild. But good for him.
It reminded me of, remember the Steven Dorff, like the first e-cigarette? He was promoting that and the tagline of the commercial was like, we're all adults here.
It's very that.
Because it's like, it's spiked soda, hard soda, done clean. But you are correct, Smith Jared, famously a sober character.
Should we try this hard soda? I think the PR did reach out to us, but we haven't responded.
Oh, of course.
Okay, big television news.
Basically HBO-centric TV news. Two series have finaled? Is that a way to say it?
I would say have come to an end.
They aired their season finales, Hacks and Euphoria. Rough time for HBO. No comeback, no Hacks, no Euphoria.
I'm truly so sad that this beautiful two-month period of time is over, because having those three shows on HBO air simultaneously was incredible. Be warned, this discussion will contain spoilers for both of these shows, because there is truly no way to talk about these episodes without spoiling things. Shall we start with Hacks?
Let's do it.
What do we think of the cancer?
Wait, what? This season, I just thought that it was beautifully planned out, because they seeded in very early, like, oh yeah, I'm getting a biopsy, I'm, you know, oh, I gotta go in for some imaging. And so they really played that cancer storyline very smartly, and then threw so much shit at you for the rest of the season that you forgot, oh right, Deborah might have cancer.
Right.
It's also a series finale where the actual last episode really is an epilogue. I mean, that penultimate episode where she finally does her final show, question mark?
Yeah.
Her big show. If the series had ended there, I think everyone would have been satisfied.
Totally. I was similarly impressed with the way that they seeded the cancer storyline. However, I feel like if we're giving Deborah Vance terminal cancer in the last episode, we gotta take it one step further. I had the expectation that she was going to get inside one of those suicide pods, instantly regret it, and then scream at Ava to get her out.
That would have been funny. I thought if they were going to travel and go on one last trip, that it would seem more like the film The Bucket List. Like, they would have gone to more places than just Paris.
Yeah, I don't know. The Paris stuff was a little weird. There were some great scenes. Like, I definitely cried when Ava ultimately confronted her about why she wasn't seeking treatment and stuff. But then there are other scenes, like when they're walking through the Louvre and Ava's like, did you ever think your comedy would be judged differently if you weren't a woman? Like, these are not conversations that people have, you know, especially people that have known each other for as long as Deborah and Ava have in the world of this show.
Well, also because so much of this season has been commentary, more figuratively than literally, about their relationship, their love story. There was a certain part during this series finale where I'm like, does Deborah's daughter DJ even know she has terminal cancer?
I know, the fact that she's not taking this trip with DJ is hilarious.
And her grandchild?
She gives no fucks.
So there was a part of me that had a little bit of a difficult time engaging in Ava and Deborah's last dance, let's say, in Paris, because it's like, you have a whole ass daughter and grandchild and you are choosing to spend your last days with Ava.
With this, like, Silver Lake bisexual that stumbled into your life.
And then it ends with Deborah not immediately choosing to kill herself in a glamorous Switzerland suicide pod, but instead she wants to do another hour. And that is said in, like, the last few minutes of the series finale. And to me, that kind of undid the penultimate episode of like, we spent the entire season, the whole missive was this idea that you want one last special you're going to be remembered for.
Yeah. And now you're already workshopping your cancer special.
So I understand the idea that a comedian will be a comedian until quite literally the day that they die. But I was like, it felt a little bit of a hat on a hat of like, but you were done doing specials. You did a special in Central Park.
But I actually do like that Deborah realized that she couldn't kill herself because she wouldn't be able to write jokes about it. That feels very, very true to the character. And I, of course, loved the song choice, which is the famous duet, the famous medley that Barbara Streisand and Judy Garland did of Get Happy and Happy Days Are Here Again.
And I will say, although I wish that they had traveled to more places than Paris, the match cut of the Eiffel Tower to the Vegas Paris Eiffel Tower, brilliant.
Great. Loved it.
Do we want to get into Jimmy and Kayla's storyline, the other platonic love story of this series?
Sure.
So they don't have their firm anymore. They go back to Kayla's father's management firm. Jimmy has been demoted to the mailroom. But the other thing that they seeded really well in this season is that moment where that widow comes up to Jimmy a couple episodes ago being like, you heard my husband in that ad too? My children think I'm crazy. Here, talk to them. And it's like a moment in between Jimmy doing other things. So you're like, oh, okay, it's a woman being crazy. But this sends Jimmy off on a path, because he's in the mailroom, he can see all the billing, that they are indeed illegally using the voices of dead actors they used to represent in AI ads.
Very well done.
And then that is used as blackmail so that Jimmy and Kayla can run the management company, which I do love Kayla's father, who's like, fuck it, this industry's dying, like, take it, who cares? Why do you think I had to use the voices of our dead clients anyway? I mean, incredibly bleak, but incredibly accurate to where things are in the industry.
Yeah, in Jimmy's big motivational speech to the Latitude staff members did hit.
Did it?
I thought so. I thought it was suitably inspiring, but I'm really going to miss these characters a lot. And I'm very jealous of anyone that gets to see Meg Stalter in Oh Mary in New York, because that is going to be incredible.
And the fact that we can't go to the Deborah Vance-backed hotel that Marcus is running.
I know. Why doesn't the Diva exist? It's such a good name for a Vegas hotel.
It is also the thing that we desire from Vegas, which is like, just give me like a gay man and an older woman's vision of what Vegas should be.
Totally. I'm with you. You want to hear something wild, Lauren? Plastic doesn't just disappear. It breaks down into smaller and smaller pieces that stick around in our environment.
I know, it's terrifying. There are microplastics in the oceans, in our food, even our cleaning products. Good thing we use Blue Land, though.
At Blue Land, they believe that cleaning shouldn't come at the cost of the planet. That's why their formulas are 100% plastic-free, so you can rethink everyday routines in a way that reduces unnecessary waste.
And of course, their color-coordinated Forever Bottles and tablet-forward approach is just an incredibly chic way to clean your house.
Yes, from cleaning sprays and toilet bowl cleaner to dishwasher and laundry detergent tablets, Blue Land products are independently tested to perform alongside major brands, and the formulas are free from dyes, parabens, and harsh chemicals.
I truly love the whole range of products. I just ordered more refill tablets for their multi-surface cleaner. But Chell, have you ever used their toilet tablets? You pop them in your toilet bowl, it fizzes, it foams, it's like a bath bomb for your toilet, and it's proven to work on a range of stains including rust, mineral deposits, limescale, and hard water.
Blue Land is a certified B Corp and Leaping Bunny cruelty-free certified. Their formulas are EPA Safer Choice certified, and many products have also earned Cradle to Cradle's Gold Material Health Certificate.
Make the switch today. Get 15% off your first order by going to blueland.com/outfit. That's blueland.com/outfit.
Okay, Euphoria finale? Is Rue a cow?
I think Rue may have been reincarnated as a cow.
I almost spit out my pet gnat when I realized that Rue was a cow. A calf, specifically. A 3-month-old calf. She's in a better place now, aka the barn.
Well, at least Sam Levinson, we did discuss this, you know, in the opening episode, Rue comes upon some sort of Amishy, religious, FLDS-esque family.
But one of them is hot and has Instagram face?
Yes. And so throughout the season, I was like, is this going to come back? And I'm happy that Sam Levinson was able to thread that needle and did, but I had assumed the way it was going to come back is they were going to take that Instagram face hot daughter and put her in Alamo Strip Club, or like Maddie would have used her for as an OF model.
Yeah.
Which is still possible.
True. Maddie did survive, thankfully.
So should we jump things back to the penultimate episode where Jacob Elordi dies?
A really horrible death. Maybe the worst death I can think of.
I have some logistical questions for you. He died from the snake bite, not the lack of oxygen, because there was an air hole.
Yeah, he died from the snake.
Okay. I have to say, I was thinking throughout that second to last episode of Euphoria when Maddie decides to go to Alamo for $1 million and basically be in debt for the rest of her life to a very, very scary man. I was like, that's a really good friend. I don't think I would do that for Chelsea.
Fair enough.
In this metaphor, I might let Tatiana die.
Okay, that is fucked up. Actually, wait, now I am judging you when you put it that way.
No, I wouldn't really do that. But is Maddie's great love Nate or Cassie? Because why would Maddie have done that?
For Cassie.
That's the other. Hacks and Euphoria have more in common than we thought. Another great platonic love story, Maddie and Cassie. Did you see the behind the scenes for that episode where it shows the production details of how they were able to shoot Jacob Elordi in the coffin and his death scene? Because you've never seen someone more happy to die on screen. Jacob Elordi was like, I'm done.
I did not see that. No. I'll circle back. What was good about the finale? I would say the escape from the Nazis was a pretty gripping sequence.
Yeah, I mean, the show has drifted this season from being, as I've said before, a Coen Brothers film to like a Tarantino film. Then it just became the film Sicario.
I also thought the raid was satisfying, the Nazi raid.
Laurie's death.
Incredible.
The puzzling thing about this season is obviously the characters that I have a relationship with from the prior season, Chloe Cherry, Laurie. But when it's that sequence where it's the father and then the other Nazi and the father's like looking at the dog and he's like, what should I do? I'm like, sir, I don't know you. I don't care if you get shot by the cops or like commit suicide by cop. Like, I don't know you.
Well, I don't really know half of these people.
I don't know why we're devoting so much screen time to you. I love this dog. I hope nothing bad happens to the dog.
And then we get 1 minute of Jules painting the ugliest painting I've ever seen. This is very like me in high school listening to Tori Amos like painting something like this.
It felt like a self-portrait Julia Stiles would have painted in a late 90s film.
Totally. But it's, of course, a portrait of Rue in hell. In heaven.
I also watched the behind the scenes for this episode because it just auto-generates after you watch Euphoria that I guess Hunter Schafer did do these paintings.
Okay, but she couldn't have possibly done the Surratt-inspired one that was the prop for LA Nights. And that lack of continuity annoyed me.
You would be correct. I just, the BTS just showed her doing the Rue portrait. And so Hunter Schafer was explaining that she was imagining the Euphoria that Rue experienced through her drug addiction. And so that was what that was supposed to represent. Although, I don't know, you just see her sugar daddy kind of come in and go out of the scene. But seeing that he was upset about Rue's clothing that he thought was another guy, wouldn't he be like, who is this bitch that you keep painting? And you're sobbing over.
Totally.
So Jules is just in a gilded cage?
That appears to be her vibe. Lexi's ending was that she read the Bible.
And I guess she's still a writer on LA Nights. The sex work conversation, like, I'm fine with Sam Levinson wanting to make his own version of, like, a Taylor Sheridan show, but in the world of Euphoria, like, fine. Shootouts, great. The most insane way to kill yourself I've ever seen in my life, I'll go with it. But just to jump back to the previous episode, I'm sorry, in the year of our Lord 2026, Cassie loses her role on LA Nights because Sharon Stone finds out that she has an OnlyFans?
I think Sharon Stone knew that, but she just got pushback from the network.
The executive, played by real-life mega producer Brian Grazer.
Right.
Not sure if he was playing himself. But the whole conversation around sex work this entire season I found very bizarre, and I'm not sure what we're trying to do with that. Because the culmination of Cassie and Maddie's storyline is that they decide to stay living in the house that Cassie and Nate had because, as Cassie explains to Lexi, I owe more than it's worth. And they're going to have basically a hype house, but for OnlyFans girls, where they will give them free room and board and also take a cut of their content.
Yeah, I love that the conclusion to her story was that she's starting a bop house.
Well, also, it's like, we're a little bit more ethical than Alamo, but like not by much. Also, up until the last moments of the episode, we're given the impression that Maddie is just in sexual servitude to Alamo for the rest of her life.
I know, that was crazy. I hope Rosalia can escape to the bop house.
Yeah, was she in that final episode?
I don't think so. They kind of only really used her towards the end of the season.
Right.
It's cool to see her. I like the vibes, but they didn't really give her much to do.
Okay. Going back to things that I liked about this episode, you had one of two choices with Rue. She was either going to live or she was going to die. And Sam Levinson chose to kill her. His explanation was that Rue's own story has always mirrored his own story of addiction when he was a teenager. And he made the point in this interview that if he was doing drugs today, he would be dead of a fentanyl overdose.
Which is what happened to Angus Cloud, of course.
It also happened to Angus Cloud. It's a little confusing because, and I've seen discourse online trying to figure it out. It's not that confusing, but it's not that Rue overdosed. It's that Alamo gave her Percocets that were laced with fentanyl because he found out that she was a rat for the DEA. I just want to pause for a second because watching this season of Euphoria, I'm like, what does this escalation of this storyline make me feel like? And I realize it makes me feel like watching the Fast and Furious series. And what I mean by that is the first Fast and Furious film that came out in 2001, they are stealing combination DVD VHS players. And by the seventh film, they are arguing with NATO about international terrorists.
See, I stopped watching after whatever one had Devin Aoki in it.
Too Fast, Too Furious.
Yeah.
That escalation feels like Euphoria. Like me explaining what happened to Rue, it's like this show started about like teenagers who are, you know, are a little wild sometimes.
Yeah.
And now it's like Rue died at 23, 25 because she was poisoned with fentanyl.
They took a big swing.
Good hair days do more than we give them credit for. When your hair feels healthy, you show up differently. You're more confident, more relaxed, and you're not constantly checking mirrors or adjusting your hair. Your hair becomes one less thing competing for your attention throughout the day. Nutrafol supports hair health from within, working overtime to deliver results you can see and feel, so your hair becomes something you enjoy, not something you stress about. That's probably why Nutrafol is the number one dermatologist-recommended hair growth supplement brand, and it's the number one hair growth supplement brand personally used by dermatologists. You've heard me talk about Nutrafol for years. It's not a one-size-fits-all approach. Nutrafol offers multiple formulas for men and women tailored to different life stages like postpartum or menopause and lifestyle factors such as a plant-based diet, so you get support that's actually right for you. Nutrafol's hair growth supplements are peer-reviewed, NSF certified for sport, and clinically tested. I started on their women's formula, and I'm currently using their postpartum formula, which targets the key root causes of postpartum thinning: physical and emotional stress, hormonal changes, and nutrient depletion, so that with consistent daily use, I'll start to see thicker, fuller hair and less overall shedding. I am almost a year postpartum. It's about time for me to switch back to the women's formula, but I will say, my hair journey has been pretty seamless. Let your hair be one less thing to worry about. See visibly thicker, stronger, faster-growing hair in 3 to 6 months with Nutrafol. For a limited time, Nutrafol is offering our listeners $10 off your first month subscription and free shipping when you visit Nutrafol.com and enter promo code OUTFIT. That's Nutrafol.com, spelled N-U-T-R-A-F-O-L.com, promo code OUTFIT.
Another thing I found interesting is up until the series finale or this final episode aired, it was listed as a season finale. So I was like, are they going to continue this storyline with Cassie and Maddie? I would watch the hell out of that show.
It should just turn into their own thing because there are characters that no longer fit in the world. Nate was one of them this season, clearly didn't know what to do with him. Jules, while I liked the plot line with Jules, she was barely on the show. Didn't seem like she was woven into the larger narrative in any way. Same goes with Lexi. The LA Knights thing felt like its own world that never really amounted to anything.
I'm with you. Yeah. I mean, we discussed this the last time we discussed Euphoria, but this was a very troubled season. It had many false starts. Sam Levinson had a particular vision for the series that the studio rejected. And I guess this is the middle ground they agreed upon.
Also, can we talk about Colman Domingo?
I was just about to bring him up because he's so underused for the first half of the series that I was like, oh, because Colman Domingo is booked and busy, but has had a long-standing relationship prior to Euphoria with Sam Levinson. If you remember, he's the principal in Assassination Nation.
Oh, I totally forgot about that.
He's so good in that movie. But really, the series finale is Colman Domingo's story. He sort of picks up after Rue dies and avenges her death and then becomes Harry Dean Stanton in Paris, Texas by the end of the show. I mean, he is literally dressed like Harry Dean Stanton in Paris, Texas in that final scene.
And he realized that violence is the answer after all.
This is also a world where sometimes the police exist in regards to like the DEA, but then also if someone is shotgunned to death in front of 50 people at a strip club, no consequences.
Yeah. I thought something more would come of that.
So a big plot hole that a lot of people have been pointing out is why did the right-hand man to Alamo empty Alamo's gun? That is how Colman Domingo is able to get the upper hand in this shootout. And it's because in a deleted scene from a previous episode, we learned that guy was the son or the brother of one of Colman Domingo's sponsees or sponsors.
Oh.
Kind of an important scene to have had.
Yeah, because I was definitely like, why did he do that? We can obviously tell that while he has this very immoral job, he has more of a soul than Alamo does. But he did have no real motive for making that decision.
I really am intrigued what the legacy of Euphoria is going to be, because 5 years from now, a new generation watches that show cold. As I said before, the leaps of narrative of like, we're high schoolers and like our friend's a drug addict to like DEA informant and shootouts.
To Cow. Is that the spinoff we get?
Rue as Cow. I think everyone involved in that show is happy that that chapter of their lives have come to an end. Whether you're someone like Alexa Demi, who seems to be the only one of this cast doing press this season, who's like, no, I don't want to work that much. Don't worry, I'm not being underused in Hollywood. I actually don't want to be booked and busy. To someone like Sydney Sweeney, who is booked out for the next 5 years.
Yeah. Well, this show was an incredible thing to witness. And I wonder when we'll get the next Skins, Euphoria type show.
I know. All we're left with HBO are these half dozen Game of Thrones spinoffs that we're never going to watch.
Rude. Okay. What else do we have to talk about?
We have another exciting museum with an amazing theater opening up in Los Angeles in September. This is George Lucas's museum, the Lucas Museum of Narrative Art, which got a major Vogue piece.
They always do that, though. That's how they unveiled the Academy Museum as well, in a Vogue photo shoot. But this one was very much about George Lucas and his wife, Melody Hobson, who is a very successful, very chic businesswoman who was the chair of Starbucks and DreamWorks.
Yes, she ran a very successful venture capital firm. You know that she's major when you read the outfit credits and it's like Melody Hobson in her own Tom Brown.
And the Tom Brown looks incredible on her. It can really go either way.
So Los Angeles is about to be blessed with an incredible museum that George Lucas has paid for himself. The rumored budget was between $1 billion and $1.5 billion, which is no skin off his back because he sold Lucasfilms, which contained Star Wars and Indiana Jones, to the Disney company in 2012 for $4 billion. And this is a billionaire who is riching right.
Totally. The building looks insane. It looks like a spacecraft. It's like a modernist space age fantasy. And the photographs of the interiors, like that elevator bank that is just like glass tubes, incredible.
Looking at the photos made me incredibly emotional. Certainly, there's been a lot of talk about the decline of Los Angeles recently, but seeing this structure and what George Lucas and Melody Hobson, their intention of trying to make it as egalitarian as possible. Anyone under 18 can come in for free. Anyone can use this beautiful library that they have. Melody Hobson made sure that everyone who enters the gift shop is able to buy something. You know, they have pencils for 25 cents. It's the best of what Los Angeles as a city can offer to people.
Totally. And while we have a million movie theaters here and we have some of the greatest theaters in the world, nothing looks like this. We don't have anything like this.
The closest we had was the Academy Museum Theater, which you referenced earlier in the episode, which to me is like the best theatrical experience. But I think this may get trumped by the Lucas Museum, which might actually make us go down to USC, an area of town we hardly ever visit.
Well, they took a lot more risks with the design of this building than they did with the Academy Museum. The Academy Museum leaves something to be desired architecturally for me, considering how expensive it was to build.
Very true. The architect for the Lucas Museum is Ma Janson of MAD. Looking at his website, it seems like he designs a lot of buildings that look like spaceships.
Yeah.
More impressive, and I would love to get your thoughts, Chelsea, is this gift shop, which George Lucas in this Vogue article is like, I'm going to be very hands-on because I recently learned in building a museum, gift shops lose money, and I know about merchandising.
Yes, he does. Can't wait for the gift shop. But also, we should get into the concept of this museum a little bit more. It is about narrative art, which is not a term that is used often. So I guess any sort of art that involves storytelling, everything except abstract art, I would say, could fall into that category.
The Vogue article gives you the impression that it's mostly focused on illustrations. Like, there's one editorial that shows from George Lucas's own collection a juxtaposition of an R. Crumb drawing with a Flash Gordon comic strip.
Right. And obviously, this includes film and all sorts of things.
It's also going to have props from the Star Wars films,
which I don't really care about, but whatever.
You will when you visit.
Maybe. They did shoot the Ewok one where I grew up, or at least the part with the Ewoks.
That is true, because when I think of George Lucas, I don't necessarily think of Los Angeles, even though he did go to USC, so its proximity to USC makes sense. But he had spent a good 10 or 15 years trying to build this museum in San Francisco, and the city put so many restrictions on him, gave him so much shit. He literally was like, you don't have to pay for it, I'll pay for it. And they were like, no. And so he went elsewhere. He went to Chicago, which is where his wife is from. And they too were like, put too many restrictions. And Los Angeles was like, guess what? We got a lot of land here.
Great.
If you asked me before I read this article, how prominent would F1 racer Lewis Hamilton be in the piece? I would have said very little. I was not aware that Lewis Hamilton, Kim Kardashian's current boyfriend, is besties with George Lucas, seemingly.
Interesting. I don't think we've talked about Lewis and Kim dating, which is really the most noteworthy bit of Kardashian news from the past 6 months.
I mean, Kendall and Jacob Elordi are dating.
That too.
Jacob Elordi, who was supposed to be on the Cannes jury and was like, I can't because I injured my foot, then went to Japan with Kendall.
Right. Oh my God, speaking of the Kardashians, something horrible happened to me. I had one of Kourtney Kardashian's Lemmy Sleep Gummies, which is like a melatonin gummy.
Did you not know it was a Lemmy melatonin gummy?
I knew it was a Lemmy melatonin gummy. What I didn't know is that when certain people take melatonin, they can have vivid nightmares. I had the scariest dreams I've ever had. I woke up in a sweat, panic. And it's because I haven't used melatonin since I was in high school. I tried it back then when I first started having insomnia. I was like, this shit doesn't work. Never tried it again. But apparently some people have this exact reaction to melatonin. So I can never have one of those Kourtney Kardashian gummies again.
You're just making me really wish that she had some commercial for these melatonin gummies where, like drug ads, she has to read the possible side effects in her very monotone voice. Vivid nightmares that will wake you up in a cold sweat are possible.
Can we get into Steven Spielberg's new movie?
George Lucas's friend, Steven Spielberg. I love that you put Disclosure Day trailer and early chatter in our outline for this week because I've seen the trailer months ago. Has this just come on your radar?
I just found out about it this week.
Okay, this explains a lot because this movie seems engineered for you.
I know. It really does. And it's not even that I'm the biggest Spielberg head. Like, I haven't loved a Steven Spielberg movie since Minority Report. And that has to be over 20 years old at this point.
I believe almost 25 years old. So Disclosure Day sees Steven Spielberg get back on his alien shit. The log line is, if you found out we weren't alone, if someone showed you, proved it to you, would that frighten you? Yes, bitch.
Well, you should be frightened because it is real, Lauren, just so you know.
Okay, the logline continues. This summer, the truth belongs to 7 billion people. We are coming close to Disclosure Day. Now, I sent you a clip of Joe Rogan excitedly talking about Disclosure Day and the trailer. And they kept talking about Disclosure Day as if this is a known thing in the UAP community, to which I asked you, is this a thing?
To my knowledge, Disclosure Day isn't a thing, but disclosure is a very commonly used term in the UAP truther community.
Which is, when is the government going to disclose that these UAPs actually exist?
Yes.
Okay.
How would the public react to disclosure? It's used in those sorts of contexts.
That blew my mind because I was like, oh, this is not an original idea. I guess he's an OG UAP person.
He is. When you consider Close Encounters, a lot of the stuff in Close Encounters very much mimics experiences that people have actually had.
Oh, I just had a frightening thought of Spielberg on Joe Rogan to promote this movie.
I don't think he'd do that. He doesn't need to do that. Joe Rogan is already promoting this movie himself.
So the idea is that, and this is a real thing within the UAP community, that over the last 50 years, let's say, the government has sort of tested out, could we reveal this information to the public? And they've just been like, it's too much.
Well, it's been more than 50 years. This would have been since the 1940s.
Okay, sorry.
Well, I'm just saying.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it is understood that disclosing this to the public could cause mass hysteria, could threaten some religious institutions, theoretically. There would also obviously be questions about things like reverse engineering programs, you know?
Meaning, can the UAPs reverse our technology or can we reverse theirs or both?
Can we reverse engineer their technology? Basically, the thing is we are in an arms race with China about who can reverse engineer these crafts first. And whoever does will have a huge military advantage and everyone else will be fucked, basically.
Do you think it's less that Steven Spielberg wanted to make another alien film and it's more that Spielberg wants to force the government's hand to actually have a disclosure day?
I don't know about force the government's hand. I think his perspective on it is more like this is happening. And what if the government was upfront about it? What would that look like? But what really attracted me to this film from watching the trailer was what I saw of Emily Blunt's performance.
Which is not AI. They've started the press run of this. So in the trailer, she is a meteorologist and she is overcome with some sort of entity and starts speaking in
alien like language, basically. Terrifying. And in the trailer, I think it's suggested that she was abducted as a child and, you know.
Yeah, she has some connection to Josh O'Connor.
There is a really bad CGI deer in this trailer, yeah. Unfortunately, that looks like shit. That sucks. but I can deal.
But then they seem to have done practically Josh O'Connor running from the police, the government, and driving a car through a house.
Perfect. Can't wait for that. I'm so excited. I will be there on opening day. I will buy whatever stupid themed popcorn bucket AMC is producing. I'm down.
You know what? That's the movie you should break your 4DX cherry on. We should see Disclosure Day in 4DX.
You're right. That's perfect.
I did think it was cute before we move on. I don't know if you saw this photo, but Josh O'Connor, Coleman Domingo, who's also in this movie, Coleman Domingo in everything, and Emily Blunt, they all showed up to the first press day for Disclosure Day in various vintage Spielberg t-shirts. So Josh O'Connor wore an E.T. one, Coleman Domingo wore Jurassic Park one, Emily Blunt wore a Jaws shirt.
I saw a tweet of that photo that was like that one wall at Urban Outfitters.
Oh, God.
And it's so true.
Wow, wow, wow.
I forgot about that wall. I don't know if they still exist in Urban Outfitters, but they certainly did in the early 2000s when we would go into that one on 14th Street and 6th Ave.
Yeah. I don't even know what's in an Urban Outfitters anymore. There's the one that's on Ventura, and I was recently running errands, and Paul was like, when was the last time you went into that store? Because that was like my teenage Urban Outfitters. And I was like, I definitely stopped buying like 15 years ago. But there was a time where I would just walk in and go, anything resonating? And I'm like, no, I'm too old.
I know. I used to shop there all the time. Buying those horrible like early 2000s like scoop neck t-shirts that were just so long.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and like horrible leopard print skinny jeans.
Guys, that was Chelsea's silhouette in college. You had skinny jeans. You had the Jeffrey Campbell.
Don't even talk about it. I'm traumatized.
I mean, I wasn't much better.
That was a really rough time for fashion, not just for us, but for everyone, which is why when I see younger people sort of fetishizing the street fashion of the early 2000s and the indie sleaze look, I'm repulsed by it. Because for me, fashion was disgusting then, unless it was like, you know, Alexander McQueen, Nicola Ghesquiere, like high fashion type stuff. But street fashion, ew.
Yeah, but they're not really trying to recreate it. It's always like Kate Moss at Glastonbury. It's like, okay, the best of the best.
Actually, Kate Moss was the best thing happening in terms of street style during that period, for sure.
Of course.
Okay, what else? Charlie XCX's album cover.
Music, fashion, film. She has debuted the... Are they still album covers? Speaking of being way too old.
Of course they're album covers. What else would they be called?
I don't know. The digital art release for Charlie XCX's new album. Anyway, it features John Cale, Marc Jacobs, and Martin Scorsese in a very moody black and white photo that honestly could be a John Varvatos ad.
Oh, for sure. It's so John Varvatos ad, actually.
But I do think it's really smart for her to take this direction because it's basically impossible after you make an unbelievably zeitgeisty album to do a follow-up. So I think everything she's doing sonically and then also artistically with this cover art to do a complete 180 is probably for the best.
Yeah, it is a hard pivot. And it's the opposite of what we expect for a female pop star's album cover. We expect a photo of a scantily clad woman looking really hot, you know? Like, that's what pop album covers have been historically. So this is very, very unique in that respect.
So John Cale, people probably have an understanding of him given his collaboration with Charlie XCX earlier this year on the I'm Gonna Die in This House song from Wuthering Heights. But most famously, he was a part of Velvet Underground. And I think our favorite fact about him, married to Bessie Johnson for a time.
Love it. He is the least surprising of the three, just because he's recently worked with Charlie. Mark, not super surprising in that he is so aware of youth culture that he would obviously say yes.
And she has been in Marc Jacobs campaigns, a Heaven campaign and then a Marc Jacobs bag campaign a couple years ago.
It's Martin Scorsese that's the surprising choice.
Well, Marc Jacobs is surprising just because Anthony Vaccarello of Saint Laurent was in her SS26 music video, and she is currently a brand ambassador, the beauty ambassador for Saint Laurent. So you would think it would be him, but Marc Jacobs, I mean, anyone would recognize him, I think, or most people would.
He hasn't had a long enough career. And even Marc Jacobs, like, Marc Jacobs is not of the same generation as John Cale and Martin Scorsese. Like, no. These guys are in their 80s. He is in his 60s. Like, he is Gen X. He is young to be on this cover.
He's the youngest person on the cover.
Yeah.
Yes, the Martin Scorsese inclusion is the most puzzling. We don't really have any context for it. Obviously, Charlie is in movies now, but I have to assume that this is because
his daughter.
Yeah, his chronically online TikTok famous daughter, Francesca Scorsese, when the request came in was like, you have to do this, Dad.
Yes, correctly. But the release of this album has led to a lot of AI fan edits where people are recreating it with three different people that embody music, fashion, film, respectively. So I wanted to ask you, Lauren, who is your trio?
Madonna.
Okay.
Michael Mann.
Okay.
Azzedine Alaia. Can I include someone who's passed away?
No, you can't include someone that's passed away.
Fine. Phoebe Philo.
That would be cool. See, if I had to do the same John Varvatos style photography, I would want to go with anti-establishment people. So I would do Patti Smith, Rei Kawakubo, who would never say yes, but in my fantasy, she did, and Whoopi Goldberg.
That's good. That's really good.
I feel like John Galliano could have been another choice for fashion. He probably would have said yes, I would think. Whereas, like, Miuccia Prada, like, would have definitely said no. Donatella would have said yes.
I almost picked Henry Rollins. While I love Black Flag and his work in Black Flag, I mean, I guess I could have also picked him for film as well.
He's music, fashion, and film.
Yeah. Just three Henry Rollins.
You know who would also be good? Cher.
Oh.
That's one bitch for music, fashion, and film.
I think we solved it. All right, what else? I mean, this has been talked about to death at this point, but over the weekend, Dua Lipa and Callum Turner married in a civil ceremony at the old Marylebone Town Hall.
So who did she marry exactly?
Oh, I was going to ask you this because you have face blindness with actors. He is a British actor. He started out as a model. He is rumored to be the new James Bond.
Okay.
He is in that movie we've seen the trailer for, One Night Only, which is that new rom-com where it's an alternate reality where single people can only fuck for one evening, which is not explained in the trailer, and we got very confused.
I don't even remember that, but I'll take your word for it.
He's been in, you know, an Apple TV series called Masters of the Air, a George Clooney film called The Boys in the Boat, things we have not seen.
Right. Okay. Dua Lipa wore Schiaparelli, a clear homage to Bianca Jagger's Yves Saint Laurent wedding suit. So cute. I feel like there's nothing better than a bride who looks unfussy, you know?
In haute couture.
Yeah, it doesn't look like she was trying too hard. It doesn't look like she was uncomfortable. I think wearing a skirt suit is inherently more casual than wearing a gown, especially a poofy princessy gown.
Well, yes. And I thought it was very cool that she did a Carrie Bradshaw and Mr. Big move of having a civil ceremony. I was reading in the New York Times that they were not able to rent out this venue because it's not available for private events. So she and Callum Turner got married with 11 other people. And I assume that she chose this location because other famous Brits have gotten married there, including Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr, Liam Gallagher, Jude Law, as well as Lena Dunham and Sylvester Stallone. So go figure.
Okay, you make these people sound like couples. Lena Dunham and Sylvester Stallone, Ringo Starr and Paul McCartney. I also loved the bouquet of poppies. I feel like this could potentially set trends. Because they were poppies that were like at the peak of their blooming, which happens like roughly 30 seconds before they die. Like they caught these poppies on their last moment of life.
She's so cool for that.
Yeah.
I think she will start another trend because there has been, and we've discussed this, a lot of celebrities tend to borrow from Grace Kelly's wedding dress as like the go-to bridal reference. And I feel like Dua Lipa has opened the door, even though we knew to us, Bianca Jagger's Yves Saint Laurent skirt suit is like the wedding look. Something you recommended I get married in, actually, will be kind of the go-to reference. I think we're going to see more bridal skirt suits.
I hope we do. I think it's always a good look.
I also thought it was cool that she got married in a civil ceremony. I was like, you know what? Who needs a big wedding? And then yesterday I saw paparazzi images of her and Callum Turner on the way to Sicily because I guess this weekend they'll be doing a 3-day wedding celebration.
Okay. And this is where we're getting the big Schiaparelli gown.
I'm sure. Yes.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. In other wedding news, TMZ reports that Karlie Kloss was invited to Taylor Swift's wedding.
I wonder who leaked that.
I don't know.
But Chelsea, I don't understand. They were friends and then they had a falling out. Why would Karlie not be invited to Taylor's wedding?
Well, look, it's very lesbian to go to your ex's wedding, you know?
Oh, you're just outright saying it.
I've done that. And, you know, it is possible that Karlie could have a speak now moment, potentially. And they could run away together graduate style. Hashtag Kaler truther fantasy.
So you're specifically a Kaler, not necessarily a Gaylor truther.
Yeah, I'm Kaler more specifically. I don't think that she's secretly gay. I think that she's like, has a touch of the bi.
This is something that Chelsea and I debated during our live show, which is available for purchase on our Patreon, something we didn't actively promote as a segment because we were terrified that Taylor Swift would sue us, and still are. But it seems like they buried the hatchet if Karlie Kloss is coming to Taylor's wedding.
Yeah, I like it. It makes me happy. Okay, speaking of other toxic friendships, Karamo is on the cover of People magazine this week. It has an incredible headline, which is Surviving My Reality TV Nightmare.
And in this piece, Karamo reveals information that honestly, you couldn't waterboard out of me.
Truly. He reveals that he was accused of sexual harassment, I believe in the first couple of weeks of filming.
Yes, and that's the headline that's gone around. But the context that he gives is so much worse because he's like, I started to see someone during the casting process that was in the cast.
Like I had a fun and flirty relationship is how he describes it. So you fooled around with someone. My guess is Tan, Antony, or JVN. There's no way it's Bobby because they don't have beef.
Yeah, it's a little confusing because you're led to believe that the person that he hooked up with is who accused him of harassing them.
Well, that's what he thought had happened because he had hooked up with one of them. Then this complaint comes out, but he later found out that the complaint was from an anonymous third party, not one of the cast members. So I don't know what to think. I don't know what he did. I imagine he grabbed someone's ass or something.
But also, this is something he freely admits. And he's like, I was cleared of all wrongdoing. Then People magazine followed up with someone in production and they were like, we dispute his characterization of events, but this source confirms an investigation was conducted and says all parties wanted to move on with the show, which doesn't really sound like he was cleared of all wrongdoing.
Right.
He also says that the mental abuse that he experienced during the shoot included executives and producers telling him that he was replaceable at any moment, which is stressful, but also it's like, I mean, you are part of an ensemble.
Yeah. And of course, they were happy to replace any of them, I'm sure.
And Bobby left and he was replaced.
Yeah. There's the print interview in People, and then there's also the video interview that he did that was completely separate, where he does talk about the incredibly fucked up Queer Eye episode where they forced him to drive and then had a fake cop pull him over as part of a bit for the show.
Which I imagine those experiences and others that he details caused him to start drinking again, which he was sober for 12 years prior. But the last time we checked in on Karamo was the fact that he dipped out on doing press at the last minute for the final season of Queer Eye. And TMZ revealed this detail that what sort of really is the straw that broke the camel's back for him was that his mother overheard on set, she was wearing headphones while production was going and the mics were still on. Some cast members, we still don't know who, but probably Tan and JVN.
No, we know. It was Tan, JVN, and Anthony.
There you go.
All talking shit about him.
So in this People magazine piece, Karamo confirms that, but he's like, I don't know what they said because I never asked my mother. And I was like, come on. You're getting, like Jason Lewis, like, this is a juicy press placement. If you're going to do this whole editorial, like, I need you to reveal what was said.
Totally.
However, he does reveal, and this is the piece when I say you couldn't waterboard this out of me. There have been a lot of online comments about his face and did he get plastic surgery? And he addressed that by saying that he got a botched buccal fat procedure during the pandemic because he gained 70 pounds. And instead of losing that weight, he instead immediately thought, let me get buccal fat removal and that will make me look skinnier.
Wait, he gained 17 pounds or 70 pounds?
70.
What?
I read the whole article. He says that he gained 70 pounds. And so his reaction to that was to get a buccal fat removal procedure. However, what happened was, and this is where it gets like Linda Evangelista with the cool sculpting. He had a complication where saliva was building up into his cheeks because the scar tissue had hardened in his mouth after the procedure.
Ugh. Guys, don't get your buccal fat removed. Don't do it. It'll just make you look haggard later.
I mean, this is a crazy quote. During season 2 of his show, this is referring to Karamo's daytime talk show, he lost 70 pounds because he realized that, quote, the more weight I lost, the less scar tissue you could see. The scar tissue and saliva were still there, but because I was skinnier, it looked kind of normal. I stopped eating because it helped the feeling of not having so much scar tissue. Girl, go to a doctor for a revision surgery, which he eventually did like a year ago, but you just let that slide for a few years?
I'm still stuck on the losing and gaining 70 pounds part. Like, I literally didn't notice.
I mean, I guess the plastic surgery did distract from the weight gain and loss.
Like, I feel like JVN gained and lost like 40 or 50 pounds, but you're telling me Karamo gained and lost 70 pounds?
This is what he's saying. So the reason he is doing this press piece is not because he loves humiliation, but because he recently launched a new wellness app called Key, and he plans to release a self-help book and a celebrity interview series. Guys, stop doing press before things are out. Don't tell me you're going to write a book. Do press when you have the book.
I don't get the strategy either.
My other favorite detail about this plastic surgery botching is in the article, he says he decided not to sue the doctor because, quote, everyone told him I wouldn't get anywhere. And he's opening up about his story in hopes of helping others, which, like Linda Evangelista in the cool sculpting, it's like people need to know about these obscure complications, quite like your Lemmy melatonin gummies and your vivid...
My psychosis and subsequent breakdown. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you could pull it together for this episode.
Yeah, I'm glad I was actually able to sleep last night.
Okay, so I'm sorry. You went and saw Elle, took the Kourtney Kardashian melatonin gummy, and you're shocked that you had horrific dreams?
No, I actually took the gummy on Tuesday night, which was my night off from the Isabelle Huppert screenings.
All right.
Not related.
Should I try these gummies, see what happens?
No, no one should ever try these gummies.
All right, Chell, I think we've said it all. We've said more than enough. I mean, we gave the fuckettes a non-consensual Kardashian-holics segment in between other topics.
We did. We're done for the day. Thank you guys for listening. We will be back next week.
All right. Bye, guys.
Bye.